Michael Ortol, and I'm the founder of the Christine Ortol Charity.
What inspired you to create the charity?
What inspired me to create our charity was the loss of my daughter, Christine. I lost her to a fentanyl overdose in November of 2020.
So how did that process go from that tragedy to where you're at now?
It was the most horrific thing a parent could have to endure. She was sober for about 3 years. She had been through, at that point, about 15 facilities. She was sober and really accomplished her dream of working at a sober living facility for 3 years, almost 3 years, and she relapsed there. And people are right when they say relapse. It's like, you know, being in remission and all of a sudden realizing you have cancer again. In the case of, unfortunately, of addiction, it goes back to a worse place, especially with fentanyl on the streets. So, unfortunately, it was fast and furious. She went from being sober almost 3 years and working in a sober living facility and, you know, making a difference in so many people's lives to losing her home, her car, and her engagement literally overnight and her dream job. And, we, as I've shared with you before, we did a film about my daughter's story called One Second at a Time, Battling the Monster of Addiction. And if you saw it, you could see the chaos that ensues when somebody relapses or somebody falls into the grips of this disease. And we had the Marchman Actor, which Florida's one of 35 states that has an involuntary law where you can have a judge weigh in, and if somebody's can do harm to themselves or others, the judge has the ability to go ahead and make for court mandated treatment. So she was mandated to do 120 days, and when she got out of the 120 days, not a day later, she left to go to this really bad place. I don't think she had any idea how bad it was, but to go party. Make a long story short, we were able to get her about a week later and get her into another treatment facility in Knoxville. And unfortunately, a couple weeks after she got out of that, she passed. So that last year of her life was very, I got to tell you, for the first time in my life, I really thought that losing her was a reality. I think because my business is trying to save big companies with advisory skills in the risk management insurance world, that there was part of me that I thought we could always throw enough resource. There was enough love and resources at this, but at the end, I realized it was just too much for her. I think after the relapse and all that, she lost her faith. It was horrific for us. I mean, now looking back, I know she's in a much better place. I know she's at peace. I think everybody heals in a different way. I think I did this to heal myself. I think for me, it was very cathartic. I wanted to bring her life to the world. In fact, she wanted us to do that. Michael, as you know, she left over 65 journals and projects. I didn't get them all at once. I got some from my ex-wife, some from from certain people, but at the end, it ended up being over 65 projects. I mean, 50 that at any point in time I had in my possession, and it was the toughest thing in the world the first 2 to 3 months going through them. At the same time, FSU was like, hey, Mike, when you're ready, we'd like to talk to you again about the need we have. Remember, we're now in the beginning of 2021 in the midst of a horrific thing for the world from a mental health standpoint, being COVID, isolation. So I told FSU when I was up and running, I could do something. And I shared that because we were doing multiple things. About 6 months out, I decided to do the charity, to start the charity, and also start going up to FSU at the same time. And with some amazing people building out the LIFT program, which is our College Recovery Community at Florida State. So that took about a year. Making this documentary called One Second at a Time took a year. So about the same point in time, which was last year, we released both One Second at a Time, Battling the Monster of Addiction, which is my daughter's story through the eyes of experts, her own words and journals, and loved ones. And what it is, it's really a documentary, but it feels like a film. There's an animation reenactment. So it's won 61 festival awards to date. So you literally feel like you're there watching the entire family ride. So you get to see trauma, generational trauma, adverse childhood experiences. You get to see stigma within the family, within the community, the AA community versus the MAT community. You get to see everything, you know, from an insider and also from an outsider, from friends who kind of knew, friends who had no idea. But you get to see the beauty of the person, and yet you get to see the monstrous part of this disease. And you get an idea that people that suffer from this, they're suffering from isolation, they're suffering from trauma. And that's what causes the mental health issues, and that's ultimately what causes them to want to use something to treat that pain that's unmanageable for them. So along the way that we're working on this film, One Second at a Time, we were also seeing the benefits and the successes that we're having at Florida State. So we started filming a mini documentary called Safety Net, helping college students in recovery thrive. And we premiered both of those in Tampa as well as in Tallahassee at Florida State University last year.
Can you tell me a little bit about your own mental health journey?
Yeah, no, I from a mental health standpoint, you know, we, as a 65-year-old Latino, as a Cuban, I don't remember seeing my dad. Obviously, I saw him when I was young, but at 2 years of age, he was jailed in a Castro prison by my own grandfather, by his father-in-law, who was a communist. And it shows the typical immigrant plight. My mother and grandmother fled in different ways. My mother was under heavy watch because it was her father who was a communist, you know, official, high-ranking one, Che Guevara's best friend. So my mom left. She couldn't leave for a while. I didn't see my mom until I was 7. She left to Cuba and had my daughter there. She had visited my dad inside prison and got pregnant with my daughter. I mean, with her daughter and my sister. And then my grandmother came here directly after he was in prison because we had a chance to get away. And that's when Cuba was allowing the freedom flights into the U.S. So we were raised in Miami Beach, was raised in a tough environment, had loving mom and grandma, but unfortunately there was a lot of drinking in that household. There was a lot of pain and trauma from, how do you explain it to anybody? My dad was a political prisoner of war. I didn't understand that. I was a kid. So here I'm thinking, my dad's in prison and my grandfather put him in there. I'm just a child trying to settle up with that. So I stayed around for a year after I graduated high school, and I'd gone to community college for a while and then felt I needed to leave for my own mental sanity. Went to Florida State, which became like my home. Graduated, had this amazing career, still in it, in the insurance and risk management business. But I fell apart again because I was broken inside, but not knowing it, filling it up with work, and got married, had a family, had Michael first and then Christine. And as soon as we had Christine, we started going through what ended up being a 3-year tumultuous divorce, Mike's wife and I, and it crushed Christine and my son. So that affected me because I saw the effect that had on my brother and my sister and myself when our parents got divorced. That started making me kind of lose myself, and I had thought treatment and therapy at that point in time for my own mental health issues and my own substance issues.
How has this organization helped your own healing process?
Oh, it's been tremendous. I mean, I got to, you know, you learn a lot. I mean, you either get through something stronger. I mean, it either kills you or makes you stronger. This was something I never planned. I mean, that last year of her life, I know is imminent, that if she didn't want it more than us, she'd probably die, especially with fentanyl in the world. When you look at how bad fentanyl is today, when we started this charity, 42% of all fentanyl was lethal for the DEA, of the confiscations. Then it climbed to 60, and now it's 70%. This year, we think it'll hit the high 70s. So it's almost doubled in lethality. So you can imagine, and it's not even for children or adults looking to get high anymore. It could be somebody who lost their, you know, prescription to Xanax or Ambien, and unfortunately, they get something that's laced with fentanyl, or a child wanting to mess with vape, or an adult for the first time, or get high on cocaine, or get a pill, a downer, or an upper. It's in everything. So, unfortunately, that's what took my daughter's life. So, I had to do that work that I never really did. I kind of did, but I really didn't do. And you have to do if you lose a child, because if you lose a child, you have every horrible emotion that you can imagine. You have anger, and you have guilt, and you have shame, and you can't shake that. You really have to let it go. And it's amazing how my daughter always wanted me to be proud of her, and I was always proud of her resilience and her fight. And when she was sober, how she took God in and let go. And I had to do the same thing. I had to literally walk the steps for my health, my mental health sanity, and my mental health and sanity. It wasn't even then that I knew I wanted to do the charity, but I'd already been speaking to a therapist. I started seriously when my daughter relapsed, because I knew it was serious. I did probably more Al-Anon in that last year of my daughter's life than I did the first 9 years that she was battling the disease. And if you ask me, well, you know, regrets, and again, I don't have regrets now that I've given it to God, and you move on, and yeah. you accept the reality, and you know, I know she's in a better place and at peace now. And she looks down, and she's got a legacy, and she'll be around longer than we all are. And she will have done, she's already done so much, and will continue to through this charity. But for me, it was just acceptance of everything and dealing with it, dealing with my part, because she left the journals. So, you know, what at first was a curse, Michael, became kind of a cure to my mental health issues, or my journey, I should say. I don't think you're ever cured. I think you got to keep doing work and giving it to God and keep doing work. And I'm fully aware of things, or very quickly aware of the realities of it's me or it's somebody else and my boundaries, and saying no a lot now because I've got a lot on my plate. So in a way, my daughter has saved my life along with God. But again, at the beginning, reading those journals was a curse. And it ultimately became a cure. Now, when I look back at them, I could smile that I'm glad that she had the desire at times to do the projects and journals at a good recovery place, or a good substance abuse, or a good mental health center will make its residents do for their own good. She did the work, and that work helped me get to where I am today to help others. That first year was bumbling and stumbling around, because I had to learn the disease. I had to learn mental health. I'm still learning. I feel like I'm a student. I think what made me successful in insurance, I love soaking this in. I don't think there's anything more important than our mental health, our spiritual health. So, Florida State was amazing to me, because as I wanted to give to them and, build that college recovery program, I had to do work at really learning, as you would working in the field of psychology or social work, and learning about addiction. You know, what are the words that are acceptable to use? What are the words that are not? Learning the language, but really learning the theories, the application. So, and I've grown a lot. I've grown from and seen it through lived experience myself and through my daughter's situation, where, you know, years ago, I would have told you sobriety was the way. It's really, there's no one way. You know, for one person, it could be sobriety and 12 steps and God. And for another person, it could be, you know, medications for addiction treatment. It could be methadone or Suboxone, along with some kind of connection recovery group. I've learned that there's really no one way. There's whatever works for that person, whatever that person wants to get them to start their harm reduction, or if they want to seek sobriety, that's okay as well.
What was the process for creating One Second at a Time?
Oh my goodness, Michael. So the gentleman that we ended up doing the project with, I was in Tallahassee and I finally watched their film, right? These two guys that I ended up hiring, Dan Fajardo and Tim Searforce. And they had shot a movie called Break Every Chain. And Break Every Chain today has over 8 million views and thousands of police officers that have written back John Hickory, the police officer that the movie's about. And it's a true story of a police officer named John Hickory who unfortunately had mental health issues and was traumatized on the job and started drinking and almost took his life. And I love how they shot that movie in a way where you feel for that person. You see the beauty of that person, and yet you see how his mental health is falling apart and how he seeks his pastor's advice and help to keep it all together, his life, his marriage, everything, from really taking his own life. So I sat down with him and I said, what's the process? Because I have no idea how you did this. What's the process? And they said, hey, Mike, we would do the same thing we did with him. We'll sit down, we'll tape you for a week, tape your whole life, and then we're going to come back in 3 to 4 weeks with a script, and we go from there. And I will tell you, Michael, been involved in film projects before as a funder, and I never saw anything like this. These guys are amazing. They're brothers. They've been part of my healing journey. They're faith-based. That first film was with Dean Cain, and this one is as well. We shot on time, we shot at budget. Everybody that was involved in this project, whatever, wherever they were on the spectrum of mental health or addiction, or it was in the past or dealing with it, we all were better. This home and a couple other places where we shot in the US and across in Scotland, across the pond in Scotland, everybody involved in this project healed. It was providence throughout. We would go somewhere and everybody, whether it was a driver or somebody involved in a shoot, was meant to be there. It was providence throughout. I'm smiling at you because I just have, my hairs are standing up in my arms because everybody involved in that project was meant to be involved in that project.
What has the feedback been?
Oh, feedback's been amazing. I mean, just the feedback from the critics to get a faith-based film to have won 61 film festival awards, a lot of them in more liberal jurisdictions, and we're still counting. I mean, we're still up for like 45 other or more selections. So we're finally going to get it out there. So the feedback's been amazing. Just the substance abuse and the mental health community, I've got an overwhelming amount of emails that we try to get back to people, but most of them, how can we see it? How can we look at your media? That's easy. Go to our website. All our media is free. So if you go to ChristineOrtolCharity.org, you can see the media for free. One Second at a Time, we will be releasing, as I shared with you before, in the month of June, where the first platform will be a major platform where we're announcing the release, the original release or the initial release. At the same time, we'll be emailing all the people that have sent us emails and giving them the ability to come to our website on a specific landing page and see it off our website. So the substance abuse and the mental health and, for example, a treatment facility, a mental health center, sober living, somebody in therapy or being counseled can watch it on this landing page. And then the second window after the first platform window goes out in the fall, that'll probably be on 7 or 8 other major platforms at that point in time. And finally, it'll probably reside on YouTube with all our media for free. All our media is for free now on our website, but all the media probably will reside on YouTube. Because I think that's by far the biggest way where people consume media.
Yeah, with the film going on streaming and then also in film festivals, how does it feel that your daughter's story is connecting with people?
It's powerful watching critics who openly are talking or come out and say, wow, been in recovery, or I have lived experience or been in recovery and I've never seen anything like this. That's really what I get. I've never seen it a film position where you get the viewpoints of experts, the sobriety experts and the MAT experts. A sobriety expert who owned one of the best sober living treatment centers in the country, and then one of the best psychiatrists for treatment in the country who's worked with NIDA and SAMHSA. So you get two of the leading experts, and then you get the family. So we're giving our vantage point of losing a loved one. What's that like over 10 years? And everybody in our family did the best they could. It was really tough to get everybody to do probably what they could do today.
Yeah.
I was healing through it, so I became more emboldened just to let go and be transparent. Instead of getting into all the stuff I encountered, we showed a bottle one day, which kind of was, in the documentary where I started falling down and taking Xanax, not sleeping, taking Ambien, and never really drank till that point in time. And this was the divorce for me. My daughter was young. That's when I started having. And I was quickly over that, but then my daughter fell. And when she fell, and here I am going back down that rabbit hole, and that's what we call it. And that's why they have Al-Anon. And that's why people that have a loved one in treatment or need a treatment have to do Al-Anon. Just as that person who has this horrible disease has to do AA or whatever, or NA or whatever, wherever they're going to seek help, whatever connection group they're doing to seek help, we have to be in a group with self-minded people. And as I shared with you before, it's a shame, but the last year of her life, I did more Al-Anon than I did the first 9 years of her battle with this disease. But to hear people in the media world like you who see all this great media and go, this is probably the most moving film, and even though it's a documentary film on this disease from every vantage point, so it did what we wanted, where with everybody would resonate in a different way. So if you've got lived experience with drugs or mental illness, it'll resonate with you. If a loved one has it, it'll resonate with you. If you're both like me, it'll resonate with you. If you're a friend or a loved one who doesn't know where they are, it'll resonate with you. If you're an expert, it'll resonate with you. If you're just in a community and know about it, it will resonate with you, because we all wake up, one in two people wake up and they have a loved one dealing with mental health and substance abuse, with the co-occurring. More, if you're just throwing mental health out there, everybody knows somebody. I mean, it's just, but if you throw somebody who's duly diagnosed, one in two Americans, and that's was it 48% before COVID? It's way over 52% now. I think the latest number from Pew Research Group was 52%. Of Americans wake up and they have a loved one dealing with it. So it's powerful, the feedback we get. And that's why I went with these guys, because they were able to have, they mastered every quiver and every arrow in a quiver, whether it was droning, animation, to share her journal. So the journals were shared with maybe a reenactment or looking over the girl that played my daughter. Or looking at a journal directly, or a reenactment of me dancing with my daughter, the father-daughter dance at my wedding, and how that was by far the most special moment in the world, because she was sober at the time. And my wife understood it. Everybody in that wedding understood. That was the most beautiful moment of my life. If I had one wish, that was it. And in that journal, in those projects, she wrote back, "Dad, I know you know this, but I want you to know that the most special moment in my life," and this is in our last year of her life when she was battling her demons, "I want you to know the most beautiful moment in my life and probably yours was our father-daughter dance." So every time I kind of, at the beginning of trying to do all this, suffered, I just remembered I have to do this. Not only for her, but why she wanted me to do it. And she always said, "I don't want to be defined by my disease, but I want to be remembered for helping those with it." And she has. And I hope I'm hoping I'm making her proud as she made me proud in fighting this thing.
How do you think videos are such an important part to help impact?
So powerful, right? I never knew the impact it could have, right? It's real. I mean, you could tell if somebody's being a phony or not, right? This thing was so real. I remember when we went out to the casting director, it was amazing how many people wanted to do it for nominal or for free, because we were a charity. And then how much talent we got to do it. And again, the closer you got to the group, because we were all healing, it was hard. But I knew my job was to let go, to just be open to kind of take off the business suit, take off the things that really don't matter, you know, because I know God gave me those skills to do this. This is my purpose now. But what a powerful medium. There's nothing more powerful. You know, I think to sit back, I mean, I'm a movie buff, you know, so I take in media like crazy. This was, what was tough here is I didn't know how to pull it off, and these guys figured out how to pull it off. I wanted to do a film, yet it was a documentary, and they were able to kind of do a hybrid. When you look at this, you walk out thinking, I just think I saw a film, but I know it's a documentary. I just got moved like it was an action and an emotional drama, yet it was a documentary. I have all this positive emotion, yet I am bawling. Every time I watch this, I bawl. We watched it at the College of Social Work in Florida State a month ago. That was probably eighth time I've seen it, and I was a mess. So I don't think you walk out of there not being moved, because it's so powerful. It's a father-daughter, a mother-daughter, best friends. You know, it's the human condition, Michael. We don't get to escape it. So our daughter is unique and complex to us, but it speaks to every family because it doesn't discriminate. So it's not something that's unique to my daughter and I, other than the peculiarities of her personality and mine and our family's unique. But at the end of the day, if you tweak it here and there, it's everybody's story. We just took the windows out of the house. I mean, we took the house down so you could look right in. We didn't even want the windows getting in the way. We put a lens on this disease to show everybody that anybody could have it. And yeah, we showed the beauty of my daughter. And we showed a father that was fallible. I mean, I'm human. I made mistakes. And how many people go say the mistakes they made? And you know, like I said, I wish I had flipped the script on doing more of the Al-Anon. But I'd go in Al-Anon, just like people go in AA and go, I don't like the people in there. They're not going to be honest like me. Well, just go to another Al-Anon meeting. But again, this was my journey. This was unfortunately my journey. It is my reality.
But you're doing so much to help others. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're doing with colleges?
Yeah, I love what we were able to do at Florida State. I was so fortunate, blessed to meet Professor Jane Dwyer Lee, who is our first inspirational story. It's powerful. It's a story of redemption. It's our first inspirational story. She's a professor in the College of Social Work. The dean in that College of Social Work at the time, Jim Clark, is now the provost of Florida State. So it was amazing, and I was blessed to meet him while he was the outgoing dean and becoming the provost and number two person at Florida State. And we just had an all-star cast of people internally in student affairs, Angela Chong and Amy Hecht, just champions of mental health, champions of recovery for students. And they looked in the mirror and they said, we're not happy where we're at. And they kind of knew what I was going to, because I would recruit a lot there. And as a graduate of the business school, I would go back up and recruit and talk a lot to the insurance school. And I was there the last year in my daughter's life. And of course, that wasn't the time, but I still took a meeting to discuss supporting lift our college recovery community. And I said, let me get back to you. And unfortunately, a couple months later, Christine passed, and it took me a while to kind of regroup, but I went back there and I said, I'm committed to doing this. We're doing a documentary. I don't know where all this fits, but we got to shoot there over a course of a year and got to showcase the things that we did, you know, right, and the successes we had. And that film that we call Safety Net, Helping College Students in Recovery Thrive, was really a showcase of what we built at Florida State. And we've shared that with about 5,300 colleges in the country. So we did that with Florida State, and we also had Christina Canfield, who's the executive director of the Association of Recovery for Higher Education. They're involved with like 400 colleges. And we also had involved Safe Campuses, which is part of Safe Project, and several, Kim Bolden, and Jeff Horowitz and Sandy Winhook, and a couple others, Mary, his wife, Admiral Sandy and Mary had lost their son the first week after he was on a college campus from an overdose. So they're brother in arms because they're doing kind of the same thing. They started a charity, a foundation, a 501c3 as I did, and they're helping colleges through Safe Campuses, and they have three other divisions called Safe Project, Safe Veterans, and Safe Communities. So the beautiful thing about this journey is you're not alone, just like with this disease, and there's others that you will find on your journey that you'll help them and they'll help you. I have found so many good people on this journey, basically to help improve mental health and or access to recovery, and really just to have the conversation.
I know for me, I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder 2 when I was 37. I'm 42 now. So 5 years with treatment, my life has changed. It's been great. But I always think, what could my life been if I found out what was going on with me much earlier? How important is it to talk about mental health and get help at an early age like college?
Michael, I think what you're doing is great. I beat myself up with, I wish I had done my work earlier, but I think you're doing an amazing job. I looked at, you know, I was excited to be on, to be a guest on this piece with you because I saw some of your work before and you're already doing it. I think for all of us, we know somebody with mental health issues and or substance abuse issues. So I think just as human beings, we have to create a space where that discussion has to be had. And I think in the world we live in today, it's a lot more, not just tolerable, we want to have that, right? And if we're not having it, you're just magnifying, you know, the stranglehold that disease has on a person. Look, every day it affects our family to some degree. It affects friends of mine. So I'm more aware of it. And I've got to watch myself because people know I'm carrying the charity hat, but it helps me have that one-on-one easier. You know, like I'm more apt to make a mental note and grab that person later. And, hey, you want to have coffee? You know, you want to have lunch? Because the scary thing is today, we're in this Zoom and Teams world where there's less interaction in the office, right? Or, you know, I'm a lot more effective working out of my office at home than going into the real office. So, but I crave, I don't know about you, but I crave human interaction as most.
Yes.
And when I'm having a tough time, it's because I've been isolating too much at home or in my own head. So, I think whatever time you think you missed, you've made it up, man. You're making a difference. And you're doing you, and I'm doing me, and I think people like you will find each other or will seek people like us.
Yeah.
Because we feel safe and we feel like we're helping each other. And I think that's the best feeling in the world. I mean, I'm blessed in business because I've had long-term business relations, whether it's vendors or clients and colleagues. And that's what we seek, a safe place where we have like-minded individuals. And what I like about us or people that are helping others is it's just getting somebody to feel safe so that we can have that conversation. And and it, I don't think anybody's truly okay, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And just to say that as a 65-year-old Latino Cuban man, you know, there's days I'm not okay. And now I know that's okay. You know, yeah. But I get there pretty quick. So, yeah, it's amazing. You talked to me 3 years and 5 months ago. I don't know what I would have told you. I was not in a good place. Or, you know, a year before that, while I was struggling with a relapse. Or when I was making 7 figures a year and feeling all alone because I was divorced and I knew the toxic nature that divorce trauma I'd taken on my children. And so there's nothing, there's no wealth, there's no power, there's no, you know, it doesn't discriminate. This gets to everybody to some degree. And I think this is one thing that we're all in it together.
What do you do to help your own mental health?
I'm a voracious reader. I still do therapy every week. I'm blessed with a great faith-based therapist. My wife is an amazing nurse and professor. I stay very active. So for me, I'm a yapper. So I play a lot of tennis. I go to the gym. I yap. I'm blessed with great friends and family. And I do this a lot. Right. And I'm blessed with long-term vendors and colleagues and clients. So the nature of the relationship has gotten more stronger because now we can talk about things that maybe were taboo before.
Right.
It's real. Right. And this makes it. I mean, this is I'm making my daughter proud. Right. I found a way to smile through the worst tragedy a parent could have. Right. I miss her more than anything, but I would not want to bring her back. I want people to know that to be able to live the reality of what happened and be okay with it is part letting go and knowing something way bigger than you, in my case God, but a higher power, had a plan, and she went through things that no child of God should have to go through. And for every person who's lost somebody, whether it's a child or a loved one, my heart's out to you. And I don't say this in a bad way, it was a choice I had to make to let go of all those negative feelings and all those feelings that kind of paralyze us, you know, like chains, and do my therapy and my work to let go and let God get in me and relinquish all that negativity, that shame, that guilt, that all that horrible stuff that like I was God, like I had control over things. The only thing I have control over is my own actions. So every day I'm really in the midst of that. Like literally, you know, I try to live my days 1 second at a time, as my daughter did. She was way smarter, way wiser than me. I mean, the name of that film in her journals, because Dad, you have no idea how hard it is on me. I'm not living one day at a time, as they say in recovery and treatment. I'm not living 1 hour. I'm not living 1 minute. I catch myself, Michael, living 1 second at a time. Because something pops in that mind and you're about to go with it and you're about to go down that rabbit hole and
yeah.
I go time out. So I think living all this, I think for you probably the same thing, as I see you smiling and kind of connecting with me on these. I think because of what we do, it makes us more sane. I can't speak for a psychiatrist or a therapist that does it all day, but I'm sure they've got something to turn to. I think with me, there's business and there's sports and reading and all that where it's balanced, but I look forward to these opportunities to serve, right, and to share my story and share my daughter's story and to share our journey, because I know it'll help other people. They won't feel alone.
Yeah.
It normalizes the conversation, you know?
And all the interviews I do, you know, definitely helps my mental health. It's very therapeutic, especially hearing stories of people with lived experiences and succeeding in life. That makes me feel good and motivated.
Oh, Hunter, and look, I didn't know how much I had with me just before it was, you know, lived mental health experience, you know, since I was a kid. Probably in my mom's womb, because I was actually born in Miami while my dad was dodging my father-in-law, unbeknownst to my mother. He knew. My mother didn't know at the time. And And my mother never thought when she found out that her father would actually put my dad in prison, in political prison. So, you know, that sets the disease in motion. Now, was she drinking, you know, during? I don't know. But, I mean, my mom was the most beautiful human being and my grandmother as well. But that bottle medicated their pain, or, you know, all the pains, right? I think the pain of knowing that for my grandmother who raised me, her husband put her son-in-law in prison. For my mother, that her father did that. For me, being confused as a child, like, where's my dad? When is he going to come out of prison? What's he in there for? What's a political prisoner of war? And I was the oldest of three, and always hiding the little bottles, the little liquor bottles. And you know, when people go, you know, what was wrong with you? I'm like, got everything. You know, you have maternal and paternal needs. And I didn't see my dad till I was 12. I saw a broken mom and my grandma and missing pieces, but they still gave me the love they could. And I will tell people that we do the best we can, but I think sometimes that person suffering from mental health, if they were able to speak their mind, they would say that probably those closest to them hurt them, when we had no intention of hurting them. And if, you know, if I was able to say a couple of things, I would say, as a parent, everything we do and don't do carries so much weight. You know, be extremely judicious and wise in what you say and what you do and how you act, because children pick up everything. And boy, I wish I could go back in time. I know that I say I have no regrets and all that, but if I could go back in time, I would have done a lot of different things. But, you know, that's not the luxury, so I do this instead, you know. And I couldn't walk away from it, having my daughter leaving this gift behind. Or as I say, you know, the cure or the curse, you know, ended up being the cure for me. But it's cathartic, as you said. It's therapeutic and cathartic doing this.
Where do you want to see the charity's mission in the next 3 to 5 years?
I don't know. I really have given it to the big guy.
Yeah.
Not the president, but the guy. You know, I know that it will have the effect that God wants it to have on people. And I think at the end of the day, will resonate with everybody in a different way. And I think it'll have a helpful effect on everybody, because I think it's just an honest look at this disease, the disease of mental health. I mean, the disease of mental illness and substance abuse. I think it's just there for you to see how it affects everybody. And you can argue, but this is just a look at this disease from a father who lost a beautiful girl and how it can affect anybody. It's somebody who says, man, I messed up. I was hurt. I didn't get the help I needed. I got the help I needed. I'm a lot better off, but you're still seeking help along the way. This is not easy, but it's worth living. If anybody tells you it's easy, it's not, but it's worth living. It's worth living. And if you're doing it with help, man, it's a beautiful journey we could be on. Even after tragedies and everything else, it's worth living. So I think that 1 second I'll be out there, and in the next year or so, that'll have a major effect. I think just in the state of Florida, because we've touched 8 other colleges, that makes me smile. So just in my home state, Florida State, we saw over 1,100 students the first year. I think this year we went way over 2,000. I think we're planning on seeing 3,000 students next year. We finally have a steering committee, and I'm part of that with a bunch of the people at Florida State or alumni. And that's a beautiful thing to have something that monitors its growth and keeps improving what we have as far as a peer-to-peer approach to recovery for students. Since that's in every other school's hands and now in the hands of their alumni, this is a problem we can't run away from. As I shared with you the other day, 24% of all students in college meet the medical definition of substance abuse, and yet less than 5% of schools have a program in place. Mm-hmm. So there's a perfect problem there, and the solution is You have to have Narcan in college recovery. If not, it's a mistake, because I think the most important thing in a college is to keep your students safe so they're in an environment where they can learn. And most of them are affected by mental health issues. I mean, if 24% are meet the medical definition of substance abuse, I think at any point in time, it's more than 40% now are dealing with mental health issues, especially post-COVID. So I think that became the easiest thing. So watching that grow and meeting the amazing people I've talked about has been wonderful. See, they're all on this mission to have kids in college and or adults in college get that help they need to get through. They want to remain in recovery or get into recovery. I think the other thing that we're doing for primary schools is providing free videos. It's through a company called Emotional Vaccines, Dr. Raul Mera and Dennis Harton. And what it does is it provides a healthy talking point on really tough subjects a adolescent or a preteen may have. It could be suicide ideation. It could be, you know, gender change. It could be physical, emotional abuse. It could be sexual abuse. It could be divorce trauma. It could be generational trauma. It could be one of many things a child, a parent, or a teacher, educator want to talk about, a counselor want to talk about. And it gives them physician-led content on how to do that. And I think that is a must-have. I think when you look at a human being that has mental health issues, it probably started early.
Yeah.
And it probably wasn't diagnosed or misdiagnosed or just left as is. And at some point in life, it becomes enough, and somebody like you and I kind of raise our hand and do our work, or something happens. And I think we need to get the right information in the hands of a child, a parent, an educator, a counselor, a therapist, somebody who can spark that conversation with that child or that teen, that pre-adult, so they can start healing. And I think that was the other major initiative. I think that in itself is huge. And as we keep sharing more content every month with people, and again, everything other than 1 second at a time is free on our website. And I love that it is. We actually just posted something about 6 weeks ago, and it's on loss. So I don't know how long it is. I think it's about 6 or 7 minutes, and it's on loss. And it's, what did I do to get through the loss of my daughter? So I worked on that with my psychiatrist and my therapist, and using a lot of the things also that I read to get where I was today and get through that. And not for everybody, it's a little different, but what helped me. So, you know, we're going to keep doing what we say we're going to do, which is we're going to keep producing media that help others, you know, stay healthy, you know, inspire them to seek recovery, or, you know, provide hope when you're down. Because I think at any point in time, we all get down.
Yeah.
And in our own brain, it could be, you could walk on the outside. On the outside, you could be looking like you're very healthy, but on the inside, you're eroding at a fast rate. And I don't think sometimes people know, unless you're living it. And sometimes you're upset when a loved one tells you because they didn't tell you. And they're telling you, why didn't you ask me? And we sometimes fail to ask people. We know they're hurting, but we're just afraid to have that conversation.
Yeah.
Just have our own family. Just reach out. Are you okay? Hey, Michael, how do you feel? You know, and I've had people reach out before, and just out of ego, not ready, whatever, I'm okay. Wasn't okay. But I think now, when I know somebody when I know somebody's hurting, or I feel like they're hurting, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, are you okay? And if they're defensive, hey, I care about you, I love you, you know, and just feeling that you're not okay. And it's just, there's so many ways to kind of break the ground on that conversation. On a conversation that used to be very super hard to have.
Yeah.
Right? I think the worst thing in the world was asking somebody, are you okay? You know, and yeah, I'm okay. What are you saying? I'm messed up. I'm, you know, like, so I think from, in the today's world, there's just nothing wrong with doing that. Especially how fast everything is, right? Like, you got to turn off the TV sometimes, you got to turn off social media sometimes, and everything is so fast, and you don't know what to take in that's true. And I think having that time for, whether it's meditation or whether it's just reflection, and you asked me before, I probably do way more of that than I, and I never did that before. I never knew how. Yeah, I mean, I think I was meditating, or, you know, I do my recovery when I'm not playing tennis, or, you know, whether it's yoga or all that, but there's a lot of reflection for me. So there are a lot of times where I'm not taking meditation. I'm just listening to Calm or another app and just kind of reflecting on my day, and just really like meditation, not really thinking about a whole lot, not thinking about 1 second at a time or the charity or work or my wife or the kids, but just being okay with nothing going on. And just maybe listen to my heart rate like I was meditating. And I don't think I could ever do that before, Michael. And I, you know, I needed to get to that place, because if not, I wouldn't have survived all this. And for me, it was just the typical anxiety, major depression, right? Obviously, those things were all, you know, happening. But through my life at different stages, a lot of, you know, bipolar, co-occurring disorders at some point in time. So I've had to deal with different things throughout my life. And unfortunately, through the biggest disaster, but blessed to come out this on the other end and know that every day I got to do self-care to some degree. And that self-care could be reflection, could be reading, could be whatever. But I always find what I need in that moment. But a lot of times that reflection is probably for me the most important. Maybe doing nothing in my office for 5 minutes and just blink. Or I journal a lot. I never journal before. I journal a lot. I journal to my daughter. I journal to myself. I journal to my inner child a lot. I had to do inner child work, and I had to do parent work, and I had to do life mapping, and, you know, just a bunch of the things I had to do and my therapeutic journey. But I just think about that. I'm always trying to think, what can I do to, even as a 65-year-old, to make me happier, to make me better for myself and others. So without pressure, like, I don't want to, there's that pressure I'd put myself to be the best in competition or at work. But now here it's just better because I feel better doing this. So there's kind of like a goal of having your legacy carry on and being able to be successful enough as a charity to hire an executive director when we're ready. I mean, that would be a goal, but there's really no goal, and then I know it'll do what it needs to do, and we'll know what's next. So kind of it really doesn't give us that pressure. We know there's a lot of, you know, power and emotion behind it, and a lot of demand for it, but I also don't want to take on the any of that negativity surrounded with the stress of these lofty goals. So that's the one good thing of, we're still small and we act more like a foundation than a 501c3. So we'll let the demand drive its success and growing, but I'm not, I'm really reluctant to put a tag on that. 8 million views, 12 million views, you know, this much in donations. I think just the story being out, and the media that we have now, and the media that we're working on producing, is more than enough. I think it will put a smile on people's faces and make them feel like, I'm not alone. Wow, this really connects with me. And they'll feel empowered to do whatever they need to do to make themselves better or help those around them. And that's enough for me. That's just, I know that's what I'm supposed to do.
How can people reach out and learn more?
I think going to our charity is probably the best way, and there you can contact me, christineortolcharity.org. You could, like, the new website's phenomenal because you can go through our media, which is free. You can go through our initiatives. You could take a look at Christine's life. It's about a 35-minute piece that we did with Dignity Life, where she's buried. there's going to be a merchandising page where we're trying to start a movement around a wristband. It's called 1 second at a time. We're going to call it the movement. Because I think when you say you have to be present, I think that's the most important thing you could tell anybody. You're not in the fear of the future or regretting the past, you know, trying to replay it. I think there's nothing stronger than being really present, especially with all the noise today. And I think my daughter was brilliant. Like I said, wise to say, Dad, I'm 1 second at a time. And she left me her art, and it was beautiful. You don't mind me sharing these two other things.
Yeah.
You know, she would tell her life through the journey of Luna, and how she was a bug, and she was ousted by her bug community because she wasn't like all the other bugs. So she took bug drug because that would make her feel like the other bugs, right? Feel appreciated and with the in bug group. And it just things like, and then Luna's new leaf, you know, this is when she got sober and kind of the metaphor of living in a bug community. And it's just amazing how she wrote as a PhD, and how I've taken all these things to bring her journal and probably like a lot of people in recovery with lived experience to life. I feel blessed to have done that. You know, if this dies out with my death one day, I'm okay because her legacy will have made a difference with this media forever. And if we're fortunate enough and blessed to, you know, grow and have an executive director, that's great too. But I think everybody who sees this will go, wow, we're not alone. I mean, that's the whole thing, you know, just to have that conversation. Because before I thought, man, do other families have this crap? Other fathers in political prison? Of course there were, you know. Other immigrants live in this plight? Yeah, of course. But when you're suffering from it, you know, Michael asked you to, probably in our own mind, we think we're alone. And I think that is the worst feeling in the world when we think we're going crazy, because we are in a way. And I could feel that reading her journals. And that was part of the grieving. I felt her pain. So I wasn't just like grieving her as a father who lost a daughter. I literally got to read it and decide, what do I do with this? And share the beauty of the individual and yet how horrible this disease is. And how we shouldn't judge people that are on the street. In fact, when we start the film, you could see me looking at somebody homeless from the standpoint of a successful business person saying, God's sakes, why don't you just get a job? And at the end, you could see me realizing it's a mother, it's an athlete, it's a lawyer, it's a human being, yeah. And something happened along the way. They hit a bump in the road, and now life has humbled them. And if they need help, somebody should extend a hand. And I think that in itself, that shows my growth. And that was done by a director through the taping, right? The taping me for a week for 10, 12 hour days. So, I mean, he really, as a storyteller, that was the other thing is, if you're going to do something like this, have people that want to tell a story to make the world better.
Yeah.
And I was blessed to have met these guys at Fire Pillar Entertainment. I sit on their board. They sit on mine. So we do all our media with them, and I put so much energy in helping them grow, because I know anything they do, they will take that that project and allow people to heal. They're healers through stories. And Michael, you're doing that.
Thank you. I'm trying.
No, I really believe that. I love the piece you did on the NAMI's chief medical officer. That was a great piece.
Thank you. Yes.
You're welcome.